From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And I'm Katie Wang, filling in for Chris Cherniak.
That's right. And joining us today for the show is Scott Lake. He's the Nevada legal advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity. Scott, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me on the show.
Well, a week ago today, conservation groups, of course, including the Center for Biological Diversity, filed a formal notice of their intent to sue the Trump administration for violations of the Endangered Species Act. And I think we'll dive right in and ask, you know, why was it that you brought that suit? What was the action that was in response to?
There are two actions, actually, and they're kind of working together. There's one project that's authorizing fuel breaks, and these are strips of bare ground or places where they've mowed the vegetation away 500 feet wide on either side of roads, and really any road across the Great Basin is now eligible to have a fuel break on it. And there's another project that authorizes what they call fuels reduction. This is a euphemism in a lot of cases for clear cutting or things that closely resemble clear cutting. So you have actual clear cutting. You have clear cutting that involves kind of wood chipping that they call mastication, prescribed fire, also something called targeted grazing where it's different from regular grazing that you see on public lands, and that it's designed to actually remove a lot of vegetation. The BLM generally follows the rule of take half and leave half for grazing, which, and we contend, is still too much. They're talking about taking away most of the vegetation. So we're looking at a lot of areas where they're just removing the native vegetation in the hopes that fire won't carry through it.
So I want to ask, kind of building on your comment about the fire, you know, what is maybe a better way to deal with this? We all know that fire is a risk because we have, you know, been subduing fire, preventing fire for so many years that we've put ourselves in this tough position. So on its surface, you know, people might hear, oh, hey, fire breaks, okay, fire management plans, that sounds like a good idea. What would you kind of recommend, like, in contrast to what was proposed here?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that there's a huge difference between the problems that we're having with wildfire in sagebrush or grassland areas and the problems that we're having with fire in forest. These areas function differently. They have different fire cycles. They respond differently to wildfire, and the way that we've managed fire in these areas is different. Now, of course, we've suppressed fire in both for a long time, and that's definitely a problem. But what you're seeing in the sagebrush areas is that you have a lot of land use issues that are actually driving this problem. You know, you have things like overgrazing, you have oil and gas development, off-road vehicle use, all these things introduce a level of disturbance that we haven't really seen historically, and the result of that is you get a bunch of invasive annual grasses that are extremely flammable, which makes it easier for fires to carry, it makes it easier for fires to get large, and we're also seeing these impacts coincide with climate change impacts that, you know, kind of create this vicious cycle. So I would say in sagebrush and in grasslands and in pinyon juniper woodlands, it really boils down to land use. We need to look at the way we're using the land, the way it's creating these problems, and really get to the root causes. Otherwise, you know, we're just kind of papering over things, and these proposals from the Trump administration, because they're introducing yet more disturbance, are actually going to do more harm than good by increasing the amount of invasive grasses. And so I think that's where we really need to be looking. Instead of this very reactive approach that's not really science-based, we need to really understand what's happening out there.
And Scott, I wonder if you'd also talk a little bit about kind of the ecosystem function of the sagebrush biome, you know, why it's important that we, you know, one, you know, as you spoke to how the land is being managed, but also what does it mean to restore this ecosystem or keep it intact, you know, so it doesn't, you know, become degraded, so you don't have these invasives. But, you know, what are the species that depend on? How does this relate to the general health of the ecosystem, and why is that important?
What you're seeing in sagebrush is that it's not really fire adapted. The same goes for pinyon and juniper. It historically had a very long fire cycle. So the species that use it aren't really used to having these, you know, very quick succession of fires like you see in, say, ponderosa pine. Some of the species that really depend on it that require some, you know, a little bit more ecological stability, I guess I would say, are the sage grouse, of course, the later sage grouse. Species like pygmy rabbit, migratory birds, songbirds, any number of endemic amphibians, reptiles, fish. One of the big issues with this plan, this Trump administration plan, is they're not looking at all at how this would impact endemic fish, spring snails, things that are found nowhere else on Earth, and may only exist in, say, 5 or 10 square mile area. And yes, species like that all over the Great Basin.
And also the sagebrush itself, it is important for sequestering carbon.
Right. Sagebrush and native bunch grasses. And that's another thing we're seeing. If you remove the vegetation, you remove the carbon sequestering ability of land.
Right. So in a way, you're exasperating the situation, right? So it's like you're trying to control it, but you're making it worse by removing it.
Right. It turns from a carbon sink to a carbon emitter. And because it's extremely arid, it takes a long time for these communities to reestablish. And one of the problems with this is that we're looking at restoring sagebrush through, you know, say, clear cutting prescribed fire, but sagebrush takes 50 to 100 years to reestablish. It's a very long timeline. And we don't fully know how to do it. So, yes, I think that the climate implications of this are huge, and that's another thing that we're seeing, you know, we're not seeing the administration look at.
So you touched on this briefly. You mentioned a couple of the species that, you know, are endemic to this area and maybe have these tiny ranges and are protected under the Endangered Species Act. Give us a few examples of those. Tell us a little bit more.
There are, and this is one of my favorites, there are a bunch of different species of small fish, these little minnow-like fish. There's a few species of dace. And there are a few species of, we call them springfish or puckfish. They exist in these very small, isolated spring-fed streams and ponds in central Nevada. And they're the relics of this enormous lake that used to exist across the entire Great Basin. When that lake dried up, all of these fish populations were isolated and started, you know, evolving, you know, differently. And, you know, each one of these populations is now unique, and each one of these spring systems is now unique. And so when you lose one, you really lose something that's irreplaceable. I'm currently working, actually, on something that's unrelated to save a species called the Railroad Valley Springfish from oil and gas development. And this is one of the species that's potentially impacted because it's also very close to some pinyon and juniper communities that BLM would probably target for clear cutting, but it's, you know, it exists in this one valley in Nevada, and naturally exists in two springs, and it's been introduced in a few others, but it's just this extremely small range. In one way, it's kind of this miracle of nature that it survived so long, and it kind of, it's a testament to the resilience of the species, but in another, you know, when you look at some of the threats it's facing, it's also extremely fragile and imperiled.
It is fascinating how these fish species evolved in these unique little river systems. So kind of getting back to these, I guess the announcements themselves or the projects themselves, are there any limitations on what, you know, the Bureau of Land Management or others could do as far as the clear cutting or the removal of vegetation? Like, you know, where does it end or what is the approval process?
There aren't a lot of limits. And that's one of our main objections to this project. There isn't really much of a limit on what BLM can and can't do. They have they call them design features. So what they essentially are small limitations on where they're not allowed to disturb the ground. These are pretty small areas in the grand scheme of things. Like, they have a riparian exclusion area that's 300 feet wide. And they're saying that that's going to reduce, you know, eliminate all impacts, which we know is not true. You have erosion, you have changes to the hydrologic cycle that result from, you know, eliminating thousands of acres of vegetation. So really, there's not a lot of limit. And I think the approval process is also problematic because they're excluding the public and scientific input from the actual site level approvals. So a BLM field office in, say, Salt Lake City or here in Reno could authorize a project and not really inform the public about it, not solicit any kind of public input, not ask how is the local community affected by this, how could sensitive wildlife species be affected by this, and simply just go ahead with it.
And so does the new administration change, you know, all of this? I mean, that's certainly something, you know, it's an 11th hour decision. I know lots happen when administrations change over, but you know, what happens with your suit once new people, once there are new players kind of in charge, or does that not make much of a difference, or are the core people that are still working on this still in place?
I think that remains to be seen. Obviously, we'll have different people in the Interior Department than we do now, and that's a good sign. You know, we also recognize that there's going to be a lot on their plate. There's been a lot of damage done over the last 4 years. And another thing that we're very aware of is that it takes time to craft a rule or a policy that really stands up to scrutiny and lawsuits. And we saw that, you know, the Trump administration, they lost in court more than any other administration in history. And it was because they didn't take the time to carefully craft these rules that would hold up. And we expect the Biden administration to act differently and to really take the time to do their homework. But that also means that it's going to take a while for change to happen. And that's, I think, the reason why we chose to sue now. We really want to stop this from happening. And we want to stop these projects from going forward because they are incredibly harmful. And I think that, you know, this is a grand experiment with a lot of risk involved. And, you know, we don't really want to push the administration to act and be maybe as sloppy as this current administration has been.
So is the main motivation for this project, you know, what we've discussed is kind of this, you know, fire management, whether that's misguided or not. Are there other potential benefits or motivations for this kind of work? Like, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, you know, why would a company or an agency want to take on such massive vegetation removal?
Right. There are other motivations behind this. And in fact, the fire control is a relatively recent justification for projects like this. These projects are really nothing new, and they've been happening in the Great Basin, in the Intermountain West, for decades. The main reason for them historically has been to increase the amount of forage for livestock grazing. The theory being that if you remove the sagebrush and the trees, the thing that grows back first is grass, so there's more grass for the cattle to eat. The same arguments would apply when these are used as, say, big game, you know, I'm using air quotes here, habitat enhancement projects, because what you're really doing is creating more forage, you know, not necessarily habitat, but you are creating more food source. That's really been the main reason why these projects happen. Starting in the 1940s and going all the way through to, you know, maybe the last two decades. And one of our concerns is that the projects haven't really changed all that much in that time. And now they're saying it's for habitat restoration, but they're doing the same thing that they were doing when it was just for cow forage and when managers acknowledged that there wasn't much of an ecological benefit. So that raises some red flags for us.
Can the work on these projects start now? Or is there some time period or additional process that has to take place before people could start on this vegetation removal?
Planning for these projects can start now. And that means that the local offices can start thinking about where they're going to do all of this stuff and how they're going to go about it. When it comes time to, actually authorize these site-specific projects, all they really have to do is fill out a two-page worksheet. And then under this framework the administration has set up, they're good to go. So it could be relatively quick. We're not really sure how quick it's going to be, especially considering the change in administration and the fact that even though the new administration can't really, they can't overturn these policies, but they could delay their implementation. That is one thing the administration could do. So it sort of remains to be seen how fast it's going to proceed. It does have the ability to proceed very quickly.
Right, but it sounds like there's also a history, as you said, going decades back, that this is, while the Trump administration certainly has been notable for its anti-conservation stance, to a certain degree, it sounds like some of these policies that are, detrimental to these endangered species have been in place for quite some time. So it's not just this one battle that needs to be won. It sounds like it's a longer kind of war to be waged.
It has been that. A lot of these policies came about, I think, as sort of compromise position under the Obama administration. And I think the difference now is that we're really starting to recognize the severity of the extinction crisis and the climate crisis and the way those two things work together. And I think we've seen some signals from Joe Biden and people around him that they're really taking these environmental issues seriously in a way that hasn't before. And we really hope that they follow through on that. And so what we'd like to see now is more of an acknowledgement by the federal government that these things are harmful, that they are counterproductive, and that we need to do things differently. And that, again, is one of the main reasons for our lawsuit. I think the message that we're trying to send here is not so much that we want to punish the Trump administration, but that we really want to see the new administration take these crises as seriously as they need to be taken.
Right, and that it's all interconnected. I mean, certainly the Biden administration has been outspoken about its, intent to address climate change, and this relates to it. I mean, it's certainly at somewhat of a micro level, but as scientists are well aware, it all relates to each other.
Exactly, it is all interconnected. And what we see happen in central Nevada, you might ask, why do we care what happens in central Nevada? but it's important because it is all interconnected. And once you lose that resiliency, once you lose that ecological function, it cascades through everything else. And there's only so much of it we can lose before it's irretrievable, and that's what we're trying to prevent. And that's the whole reason why the Center for Biological Diversity exists, to prevent extinction. So, we hope that, through this lawsuit, through interviews like this, and through some engagement with the administration, we can really bring these issues to the forefront and look to a brighter future for the sagebrush steppe and not this sort of 19th century paradigm we've been working with.
Well, Scott, along those lines, if listeners are interested in reading more about this, learning more about it, or giving their input, where should they go? Can you direct us to a few resources?
Sure. They can always go to our website, biologicaldiversity.org. All one word. It's always, I think one thing people can really do if they want to make a difference is talk to their local land managers, the local Forest Service office or BLM field office. They really want to hear from local people. Somebody like me who covers the entire West is generally not taken as seriously as somebody who actually lives in the place. And so if people really want to make a difference, you know, they can always comment on projects, they can tell the BLM or the Forest Service what they think is important or what matters to them, and just be involved. And you know, these federal lands, public lands, are part of our communities and you know, should be treated as such.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us this morning to give us the latest news. We will be following up with you once we're a few months into the new administration to see how things are progressing.
All right. And thanks again for having me on.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.